Hi, I'm Tara, and welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 4, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment. This is Episode 90, which will wrap up our coverage of Lightbringer, the sixth installment in Pierce Brown's Red Rising saga. But here's a hint, don't worry, it is not our very last Red Rising episode ever.
I'm fellow Sagas and Sass host Jonathan. This episode is titled Casus Belli, and we'll be discussing Lysander and Darrow's POVs from Chapter 79 through the end of the novel.
And I'm your other host, Nick, here to remind you that our Red Rising coverage is spoiler-free, outside of the chapters we cover in each episode.
And I'm practically permanent guest host, Seth. Don't forget that the opinions are those of us as individuals, and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole. Though, you know, let's be real, usually we're all on the same page, or close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon. With 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month, it offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment. And now we finally are at the point where we are covering the last 11 chapters in Lightbringer. Some very difficult chapters to read. We're going to start by saying, in contrast to his past visits, this time Lysander's arrival on Io is a purposeful and triumphant Iron Rain. After all, he needs maximum visual and allegorical effect so he can use this event as a centerpiece in his forthcoming propaganda campaign. Sorry, I need to take a moment there. Yeah. Anyway, the Ascomani, both in space and on the ground, are caught with their hands in the proverbial cookie jar and soundly defeated. They rescue the Lowcolors and even find a group of high-value prisoners that includes Gaia Al-Ra, who was surely meant to be found and has already been fed Lysander's alibi prior to his meeting with her. Lysander greets Gaia and the other prisoners with respect and the promises that they are here to help, not to stay, and that he will bring Fa's head to Gaia on a pike. Granted, Gaia would prefer Fa's death to be a slow and painful thing, but surely they'll find out what we already know soon enough. Wink, wink. Darrow, Cassius, and Diomedes watch Lysander defeat the Ascomani from the Archie, with Darrow seeing the ensuing propaganda. Lysander charging into the Garter, liberating both Lowcolors meant to be shuttled away as slaves and gold prisoners, including Gaia, and embracing the freed captives for, well, exactly what it is. Propaganda. Unfortunately, he also has to admit that it's stirring stuff, and that just makes him even angrier at Lysander being Atlas's good tyrant. Of course, Diomedes continues to remind Darrow that Lysander was surprised on the Dustmaker, and Cassius is also questioning whether his former charge really is working with Atlas. Thankfully, as angry as Darrow is, Diomedes does at least understand that Lysander being alive suggests that there's a new arrangement. With that admission, Diomedes is then able to convince him that they have a bit of time. Time enough to go down to Io, sneak into the Garter, and find Gaia in hopes of showing her the truth behind Lysander's theater. And speaking of theater, the Rimgolds who hid from Fa's army are shouting their fears to the wind before they all join Lysander in his attack on Europa and Fa, a ritual that for Cicero and then even Lysander himself take part in. Though Lysander's confessions are interrupted by the arrival of none other than Diomedes. A++, great timing, Diomedes, no notes. Admittedly, Lysander is relieved and happy that his ally is alive, but he's also baffled and having a hard time hiding it. Not to mention stunned when Diomedes then insists that he should be carrying the shield of Akari. They head off together to fetch it, but Lysander soon becomes uneasy and, well, kind of rightfully so, considering Diomedes isn't actually taking him to get the shield. Though they continue on anyway, even after Diomedes essentially admits to knowing that Lysander is working with Atlas, because Diomedes knows that it wasn't always this way and admits that he understands Lysander's choice. All that said, though, it turns out that Diomedes does have something quite coy up his sleeve, because when he and Lysander reach their destination, who is waiting there for them but Darrow? Oh, and Darrow also didn't know that he was going to be meeting Lysander. Diomedes was supposed to bring Gaia, so of course both he and Lysander go into fighting mode. Diomedes, however, requests that they lower their blades and, as his guests, be civil with each other.
Not that either Darrow or Lysander want to do anything of the sort, but Diomedes tells them it's his turn to speak. He explains that while Lysander helped choose the twisted path they're on, Darrow straightened part of it. His evidence being Fa's head in a box. In all seriousness, though, Diomedes knows that he is probably going to be appointed as, essentially, the leader of the Rim, and while that still leaves him the weakest power in this particular room, Atlas and Atalantia are the real problems. That neither Darrow or Lysander are true tyrants, and what they should do is find the road back to peace, with Darrow presenting Fozhead and Lysander presenting Atlases to the Moon Lords in exchange for their mercy regarding their transgressions. While Darrow and Lysander are obviously still conflicted, it seems like Diomedes finally becoming a chatty Cathy might be working its magic. Because as far as we can tell, both of them are considering his, shall we say, strongly worded suggestions. Lysander leaves one way, and Darrow follows Diomedes another. But unfortunately, there's another surprise in store, because when they reach the Archy, Cassius is not there waiting for them as he should be. That said, they aren't entirely alone, because Gaia has arrived to figure out what the heckity-heck her grandson has been up to. In fact, she's not the only one, because when Lysander meets back up with the Gorgon Greys, they want to know why Diomedes isn't with him. Lysander insists that he needs to talk to Atlas directly, and what luck! Turns out Atlas is on his way and should be arriving very soon. Once he arrives at his chambers, Lysander requests Rhone, but is told that he's actually escorting Atlas. Again, a lucky thing, because who is waiting in Lysander's chambers for him but Cassius? He's apparently already informed Pytha about Lysander's deal with the devil and believes that Cassius wants to help him just as much as she herself does. They, of course, have a lengthy chat, mostly about the past, but in the end, what's there to talk about but the future, right? Cassius believes Lysander would hand over Atlas to Diomedes, and when Lysander insists he can't, Cassius tells him they can kill Atlas together as soon as he arrives, at which point Lysander will be free and will no longer have to compromise. But it can't just be Atlas, it has to be Rhone too, and they basically can't fail. They aren't entirely alone, of course, Pytha is there to help as well, and she at least believes that if the three of them work together, they must succeed. Which is... very nice sentiment. And yet, well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. After all, their plan to ambush Atlas as soon as he lands isn't the total worst. Sure, Lysander couldn't show up in armor, but once again, he's lucky because Atlas isn't wearing any either. And as soon as Lysander reveals that Darrow killed Fa, Atlas sends most of his Gorgons away. Well, except for Rhone and a half dozen others, but at least Lysander is able to take out the extraneous Praetorians before he's knocked off his feet. Meanwhile, Cassius's assault on Atlas seems to be going as planned until Rhone fires at Cassius, allowing Atlas to finally go on the attack, while Rhone himself refocuses on Lysander. Both duels are rough, with Lysander and Cassius soon sporting several serious wounds, but with Lysander finally taking out Rhone by cutting through his calves, spilling him onto the deck like a turtle on its back before spearing him through the head three times, for good measure. And Cassius, of course, is Razormaster extraordinaire, relying on his defensive discipline despite his wounds, and soon snaking his now whip-shaped razor around Atlas's neck. Lysander calls out for Cassius to kill him, but before this can happen, Atlas blabs about the weapon that can target any color, the weapon that Lysander clearly knows about. Hey, Lysander. Big oopsies. Big, huge.
Cassius doesn't want to believe that Lysander would keep, let alone use, such a weapon, but then let's be real, Cassius has never been the best judge of Lysander's character. Poor dude. So, yeah, he's totes wrong in this case. Again, and when Lysander refuses to stand down, Cassius refuses to obey Lysander's request that he leave. And of course, Lysander is a pixie piece of shit who won't even fight Cassius for real. As with Alexander, he simply shoots Cassius until this man, who is basically the only brother Lysander ever had, collapses and dies. Cool, 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 cool. Seriously, though, we won't even bother with the I'm not crying, you're crying bit, because for sure everyone was crying here. Don't at us. To make matters worse, Lysander plants Cassius's razor just above his heart and goes stumbling through the ship lying about assassins, blaming not just Cassius but also Diomedes before pulling Kyber aside and admitting that Atlas was trying to control him, ordering her to kill the rest of Rhone's cohort and retrieve the black bag he dropped down the hangar's waste chute. Because, oh yeah, he's going to be too busy showing off his barely patched up injuries and convincing his allies of his new truth to bother with any more dirty work. Back on Io, Darrow is waiting impatiently for news from Lysander or Cassius, while Gaia is being a real stick in the mud about allowing any sort of cooperation, let alone alliance, with Darrow. She then announces that Diomedes is going to kill Darrow, but instead, Diomedes wraps Pyrphoros around his own neck and puts the handle in his grandmother's hand and tells her that she might as well kill him. Obviously, she's not about to do that, but this doesn't mean she's going to help them. She's simply not going to oppose them. Diomedes and Darrow seem to understand that they'll have to work with what they can get, and anyway, it's nibble night, and therefore time for the summit, where they still hope Lysander and Cassius will meet them. Lysai. Not surprisingly, Diomedes is appointed hegemon, aka leader of the Rim, for the briefest explanation, and brings Darrow before the remaining Moon Lords to present the gift of Fa's head and to request a formal pardon for the destruction of the dockyards of Ganymede. The Moon Lords remain silent, that is, until Diomedes tells them he has offered Darrow a military alliance, at which point they erupt in anger. Well, until Gaia puts them in their place, and she and Diomedes work together in an attempt to convince them that Atalantia is the real big bad that they need to worry about taking down. Unfortunately, as soon as the meeting seems to be coming up Darrow, a green approaches to inform Darrow that they are receiving a tight beam from the Lightbringer, and as we already know, it's certainly no good news. Sure enough, Lysander appears on screen to show off his injuries, shit-talk Darrow's presence in the Rim, claim that assassins were sent from the Garter to finish him off, and to then display Cassius's naked and brutalized body because, of course, he fucking does that. Darrow is obviously brokenhearted, while Diomedes is more enraged than we've ever seen him as he names Lysander liar. The Moon Lords, however, seem to be entertaining Lysander's bullshit, at least until he demands that they surrender Darrow to him, because Darrow is their guest and all, and they have more honor, or at least more pride, than Freys. Bread and salt, people. Sacred. Lysander, however, has -1,000,000 honor. When they refuse to relinquish Darrow, he uses the Lightbringer's particle cannons to fire on the Garter, which includes the meeting place where Darrow, Diomedes, Gaia, and the Moon Lords are located. Lacking a plan, armor, graph boots, men, and, well, any resources at all, really. Diomedes calls for order, and the Moon Lords begin to evacuate in neat rows, only to be interrupted as the pillars supporting the exit begin to collapse. Darrow races to pull an Atlas, the Greek Titan, not the jerk from this series, and hold up the proverbial sky so the Moon Lords can escape. He receives aid from Diomedes, of course, Diomedes is best, and others until many of them escape outside and rush to a secret door that leads to bunkers.
Problem is, there are still people on the surface. So while a few of the elderly Moon Lords remain behind in relative safety, Darrow and the rest, even Gaia, bless her heart, make their way to the garages in hopes of fighting back. But against what? Lysander burned the Eastern Garter while he looted the Western portion. He's going into the produce business after all, and plans to turn the Mercurian Desert into a crop heartland. While some are delighted that Lysander is diversifying his portfolio, especially as many of them will also profit from these ventures of his. Cicero, however, isn't fond of all of Lysander's actions, particularly burning the Browns who refuse to keep their orchards alive. Lysander feeds him some pretty words and they depart together. Lysander has one more thing to take care of, though, or rather, one more person he couldn't bring himself to destroy. And now Pytho waits by the ship with Cassius' body, as Lysander is allowing her to take it back to Darrow. Of course, Pytho is furious with Lysander, promising to kill him if she ever sees him again. But he still sees her off before meeting back up with Kyler, who he immediately honors by granting her the position of his ducks. With that, it's time for our least favorite little pixie shit and his space racist allies to sail home, because the Voke have gathered and Lysander knows they won't be able to hit that fleet before they unite. As they depart, Lysander returns to his suites to muse over the 14 golden cubes that make up the weapon Idmi, paying special attention to the ones marked with red and gold sigils, and wondering which Silenius would have used first. While Lysander is contemplating genocide, it seems something put a stop to Diomedes and Darrow's attempted rescue mission, and they've been trapped in the Ra bunker, where Darrow spent his time finishing his memoirs to Pax. Ash rains down on the once verdant Garter as Voke Ripwings help search for survivors from the sky, while daughters of Athena skip across the surface clearing collapsed bunker entrances. Sever arrives and explains that it took him working on Athena and Lyria, working on Volga, to get the two to combine and come to help. But then they need to show up to sign the all-important covenant between them and the Rim. That done, Diomedes promises that once the Rim fleets have done what they can to save as many of their people as possible and to make sure they've chased away the Ascomani, they will rendezvous with Darrow. And so he departs Io, though before he has gone very far, he's hailed by a ship he cannot see, the Arche, of course. It's a somber pickup, with Darrow crying over Cassius' body until Sever arrives to offer him, well, not any sweet kind of comfort. This is Sever we're talking about, after all, but conversation and someone to sit with while they bring up the Institute recordings Cassius had in his bedchambers so that they can reminisce on a time when they were idiots drunk on victory and howling at the moon. They've got a long trip home, but they're finally on their way with the army and armada that Darrow promised Virginia.
Wow, that was a really long summary. If not the longest I've ever written, then definitely top three. I kept trying to cut stuff out, and I had so many thoughts about trying to make it shorter and do this differently, but whatever. Anyway, so...
While Lysander is in propaganda mode, it seems like Cicero is doing a better job performing actual meaningful actions.
He's injured in the fighting after the rain, but when Lysander tries to get a medicus involved, Cicero insists that they help a badly burned green girl instead, ordering, "Triage, Goodman, we are made to last."
The other quote-unquote new shepherds, apparently Lysander's version of howlers, who are resting, see this happen, and after a moment's pause, they also get up and go back to helping with the relief efforts.
Good for Cicero, of course, but also, at Lysander being one-upped at his own game.
Meanwhile, Roan and his buddies continue being the worst with their whole daily slaughter bonus thing.
Though when some of Roan's cronies get kind of smartass with Lysander, Roan actually tells them off because, you know, he has a code. A fucked up one, but a code nonetheless. Like, massive eye roll.
When Lysander is brought to see the recently released gold prisoners, they are in a bad state. Beaten, bald, and barefoot.
He knows that, "To Roan, this is just punishment for their hubris and mercy considering their treason against the society over a decade ago. But to Lysander, it's a tragedy, even if they did lord his exiled state over him the last time he saw them." Lysander remembers that many of them even called him a snake and thinks, "Sadly true, but I became a snake only for their protection."
You keep telling yourself that.
Who's full of hubris now, Lysander? Like, seriously, ugh.
Overweening pride. I know. Especially in these chapters.
I wasn't a snake the first time I came to the rim, and now I guess I am, but I'm only doing it to protect them, he says, planning what he's planning. Well, I guess at this point, he isn't quite yet, I don't think, planning the full... shebang that we get, but still.
He's still the fucking worst.
Yep.
I wasn't a snake the first time I came here, but it took me all of 5 minutes to become one.
What an ass. Really.
So much.
Cassius and Diomedes still questioning Darrow's insistence that Lysander is working for Alice is at first maddening, but wow. Is it a relief that Diomedes recognizes something is up and likely change considering Lysander is, you know, alive and all?
After they formulate their new plan to find and have a chat with Gaia, Darrow asks Cassius what one thing Lysander is most afraid of losing, and that, folks, is apparently his fucking reputation.
Maybe. I don't know, really. I'm not sure, guys. What do you think? But maybe Lysander should have thought about that before doing all of the things he's been doing.
What the fuck?
So much.
He just keeps being worse. Like, every time I'm like, he's the fucking worst. He's like, hold my beer. I'm way worse than you think I am.
So much worse. It's just...
I have, like, no words. Now, that said, I made a bit light of the Rimgold shouting their fears into the wind in the summary. But to be honest, it does sound like a pretty neat ceremony.
Lysander explains that the Rim dwellers call the ritual the parting of the shadow or the expiation of fear. Since we do not believe in gods, the confession is dedicated to our ancestors. Though I know they do not hear us in the void and that we speak only to make ourselves brave and hone our intentions before battle. The importance of Gaia's invitation to partake in the rite is impossible to ignore. No knights of the core have taken part in the ritual since the Dark Revolt.
And to be honest, most of the fears are actually worthy ones, for lack of a better word. Fear of not being able to banish the shame of hiding while Io burned. Fear of breaking and running if faced with certain death. Fear that they have lost the future. Fear for their enslaved citizens already being shuffled into the darkness.
Lysander's musings kind of put a damper on it all, with him realizing that Atlas was right.
Nothing makes people fall apart like fear or come together like hope. That hope for the Rim is me, my fleet, my knights who sailed here with the virtues of the conquerors in their hearts. I feel heady with momentum.
That hope is me. I'm glad I have myself muted for that. Sure, he's not wrong, but also, shut the fuck up, Lysander. This isn't all about you, for fuck's sake. Therefore, it's hard to not find it hilarious when his turn to speak is interrupted by Diomedes showing up, just like, ah!
And honestly, who knew Diomedes could be so tricksy?
Okay, I gotta prepare myself for this.
Yes. Yeah.
Yo, Lysander, my boy, let's go check out that Shield of Akari for you. Psych! I totes know you're working with Atlas, but don't worry, I'ma still play fair, only first I just gotta introduce you to my new bro. Surprise, it's Darrow!
Darebro.
Okay.
I love Diomedes' voice there.
It's like exact opposite of Diomedes. Yeah,
What makes it perfect.
Yeah.
When I start doing Virginia as Mona Lisa Vito from My Cunning's Vinny, are you going to tolerate that?
No, because it's not appropriate.
Yeah.
He's Italian.
Wait, can we talk about the Utes?
The Utes, yeah, exactly.
The two Utes.
In all seriousness, though.
Electra and Pax, the Utes.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. In all seriousness, though, when Diomedes finally actually talks, he, not all that surprisingly, makes really, really good points.
He reminds Darrow and Lysander, I think we can all agree that today I am the most aggrieved party. I have lost my mother, my father, my sisters, my brothers, my mentor, and my home. This war has cost me all that I love, except two people. There is a voice inside that demands revenge. It tells me revenge will fill the holes torn in my heart. But I know that is a lie. Arcos, a man known to all of us, said it best. Death begets death begets death.
Lol at Lysander trying to get the drop on Diomedes about Darrow by reminding him that
for a decade he has given mankind nothing but war.
Can I just say, before I get into this, yeah, and the golds on the other side had nothing to do with that, although yeah. Diomedes yeah. is kind of.
Fuck like, Lysander's
it's,
logic.
It's all Darrow. It's not the guy that he's, you know, allying with who impaled 5 million people.
Yeah, and also Lysander's logic.
Yeah.
What's the most sarcastic way you can say logic?
Logic! He has all the logic of a libertarian who just finished Atlas Shrugged. Shots fired. Anyway, okay. To which Diomedes replies, and if you were born a red on Mars, what would you have done? When I was a boy, my father asked me that question. I said, rise, and he smiled. Darrow is not to blame for this war. Gold is. The hierarchy gave humanity the stars, but the decadence and cruelty of our rulers gave us this rebellion. You told me once that you have forgotten who we are, Lysander. You were right. We are not kings. We were never meant to be. We are shepherds. Shepherds do not rule. They guide. They nurture. They protect. Because they know it is not the shepherd who produces. It is the flock. Without the flock, we are just beggars with sticks and fancy rights. It is our time to find humility, to show we are more than autocrats.
All hail Diomedes, at least in this moment anyway. Although, as I say that, okay, let's be real. He has rarely not been at least decent, so there's that. Was anybody else just really surprised that Diomedes actually had the cojones to put Darrow and Lysander in the same room?
That is a recipe for trouble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he handled it super well.
Yeah.
Like Diomedes did.
Mad respect to Diomedes.
And I guess in a way, Darrow handled it way better than I thought he would. Obviously, he was being kind of nasty, rightfully so, and had his razor out for a bit, but so did Lysander. Lysander was kind of being a petulant little shit throughout the whole thing.
Surprise, surprise.
What, Lysander being a petulant little shit? Next you'll be telling me water's wet!
When that happened, like when they get to that room, Diomedes and Lysander, and I didn't really know who was supposed to be there or what was supposed to happen. The Shield of Akari thing did feel like a little bit of a front, but poor Darrow for thinking he's going to meet Gaia and he gets shoved in front of Lysander. And again, Darrow had way more self-control than I would have in that situation. Mm-hmm. Way more. That's a lot of respect he has for Diomedes, I guess. Anyway, we all shared Darrow's frustration when he realized that Cassius hied off to meet up with Lysander, right? Like we all did. Anybody didn't?
Look, Cassius gonna Cassius.
Yeah, it's his protege. Cassius. He's gotta make the attempt.
We understand why Cassius did it, but also, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even Cassius, before I knew what happened.
The odds are against him that he even make it to Lysander, let alone actually make it through the whole encounter. So even before we know anything, it's like, no. Mm-hmm. Also, we know what a fucking shit Lysander. Cassius hasn't interacted with him for years. So it's even more so just like, no, Cassius, you don't understand. He's the worst.
Has it been years?
I don't know if years plural, but the one thing I will say is we do know that Darrow was on the Trasheroid for 8 months.
Yeah.
And then when we think about travel time to and from the rim, we're already just with those simple things putting us over a year. Do I think it's been over 2 years? No. But I would say at least 18 months for sure. But even so, you're right, Nick. Cassius has not interacted with Lysander in a very long time. Also, Lysander has devolved as a person exponentially in that amount of time, like regardless. So
100%.
He's devolved.
Yes.
Yes. 100% he's devolved.
At first, Cassius' decision seemed to maybe not be the worst, as Lysander was willing to talk with him.
Though when the conversation turned to Ares' helmet, Lysander took from Severus' stateroom, the booby traps costing him 3 men in the process. Lysander notes that when Cassius puts the helmet back on its shelf, he does so with incredible reverence that says everything.
Yeah, talk about 3 men and a baby. Yeah. Okay, anyway. Needless to say, Lysander doesn't seem too happy to notice this.
The reverence, specifically.
The reverence, yes.
Yeah.
It is important to point out that both Cassius and Lysander felt betrayed by the other. Cassius because Lysander didn't obey him back in Iron Gold, and Lysander because he's just a douche.
Yes.
Well, Lysander because he felt Cassius chose Darrow over him in Dark Age. Which, okay, neither of them are technically in the wrong here, but also, whatever, Lysander, go cry about it, why don't you? Especially considering Cassius does, in fact, apologize for asking Lysander to be someone he wasn't and could never be, that being Julian, of course.
Big sigh that Cassius truly seemed to believe that Lysander would hand Atlas over to Diomedes. Though it doesn't really seem that Cassius, or anyone else for that matter, has thought much beyond what happens if Lysander were to do the thing.
Sure, Cassius insists that life's not all war, saying, I've always wondered the people we'd be if we weren't born with these names. Bellona, Loon. They've given us such horrible choices to make. Choices we never asked for. I know we got the riches, too, but it's not fair, this inheritance of yours. Selenia squatting on your back since you were born. Everyone thinks being born a loon is a blessing, but I know it's a curse.
And anyway, Lysander doesn't think Cassius understands and tells him he can't do the thing. And then Lysander goes on a tangent about how he acted like the hero of the rim, but he's not. And even though he really thinks he could help people, he's always just been a puppet. Plus, Atlas may already know at least something about the meeting, and Lysander goes into an anxiety spiral, because the more he thinks of Atlas, the harder it is to breathe, noting, I feel hot! My hands start to shake! This has never happened before except once with Octavia. Once was enough for the pandemonium chair. It'll get rid of the shakes. That's what she said. When I got out of the chair, I was calm. It was a while after the chair before I realized I couldn't remember my parents. I clenched my fist, but the shaking won't stop.
For a moment there, you went into almost like Scarlett O'Hara mode.
as God is my witness, I will never be on the pandemonium chair again. anyway. It's almost enough to make you feel bad for him, almost, especially as Lysander's also not wrong about how Atlas will torture and kill everyone he loves, which of course includes Pytha, who Cassius also loves.
Thankfully, Cassius won't give up that easily and offers the idea that they kill Atlas together as soon as he shows up. Though even then, Lysander clearly isn't convinced. But Pytha's arrival and insistence that if the three of them work together, they can end this now, seems to solidify his decision to work with them.
And hey, they do kill both Atlas and Roan. So all's well that ends well, right?
Yeah, no. Nope. Sure, the fight is pretty epic, even though Lysander has difficulty taking out Roan and Cassius sustains some pretty big injuries in order to win the title, the man who killed Fear.
But unfortunately, Atlas had just enough time at the end to tell Cassius to ask Lysander about the weapon. Which Cassius does, and so Atlas blurts out, Selenius's biological feed me. It can target a color, any color. On any.
Lysander interrupts Atlas by shooting him in the head, noting that
his broad smile remains, mocking me.
Yeah, well, listen, as much as we dislike Atlas, he deserved that mocking smile, Lysander, because it became obvious the moment this little asshole started looking for his prize, aka Atlas's pack containing the bioweapon, that he had not planned on destroying it.
Poor Cassius is horrified, mainly because he understands just enough to know what a dangerous weapon Lysander has on his hands.
Of course, it surely doesn't help that Cassius also realizes that Lysander used him to cut his strings, because now Lysander can pin Atlas and the others' deaths on someone already known as the Betrayer, which is honestly so fucking gross. I can't even...
Especially with Lysander somehow still believing that he never wanted to hurt Cassius, just like he never wanted to hurt Galastris or any of the other fucking people.
Lysander is such a brat and a bane to everyone around him. Why can't he just go away? Go the fuck away. GTFO, do not want. Speaking of going away, though, Lysander does try to get Cassius to leave. But this is Cassius we're talking about, so of course he isn't going to. Plus, Cassius also still wants to believe that Lysander won't kill him, saying, "You love me too much. The guilt will crush you."
Lysander claims,
"I'll learn to bear it."
And Cassius smiles at him sadly, saying, "No, you won't. But if it must be guilt that drags you down, brother, I will be your millstone." He then prepares himself to fight, interrupting Lysander's final insistence that he not do so by announcing, "I must. I am Cassius Bellona, son of Tiberius, son of Julia, morning knight of the Solar Republic, and my honor remains."
But when Cassius lunges forward, Lysander merely shoots him over and over again. Cassius, however, doesn't fall. He reaches Lysander, but seizes and drops his blade, leaving Lysander to catch him and carry him to the ground.
Lysander might be desperate for one last word from Cassius, but he is already dead, and he is smiling, leaving Lysander thinking,
"The west of the world is gone. I see a black door. I am pushing it. A chair waits for me between shafts of light. On that chair, I see a boy whose feet don't touch the ground. In his hands, he holds a candle, and with a single breath, he blows it out. And with it go all the shafts of light."
Talk about kill the boy and let the man be born. But also, we're going to get so much more into Cassius when we get to the thoughts of the people who really matter. I would say real quick, pour one out for Cassius, but I'm in an office with a lot of electronic equipment around, so I'm not going to do that. And instead, I'm going to eat a leftover Jell-O shot from Halloween, because we're recording this 4 or 5 days after Halloween. So instead of pouring one out for Cassius, I'm taking a Jell-O shot for Cassius, which I feel is kind of legit, because pre-Institute Cassius for sure would have been taking Jell-O shots with his frat bros in the bars in whatever city it was that he lived in. I can't remember, so.
Yeah, on the bars of Mars. The Mars bars.
And exactly. I'm drinking whiskey, as would Cassius.
Yours is like current Cassius mode. I'm in college Cassius mode.
Mm-hmm.
Or high school, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, I suppose you could say that we get a small pick-me-up when we head back to Io, because despite Gaia being, you know, like super difficult at first, Diomedes does a grand job of putting her in her place.
Not only did he repeat his message that gold has failed in its duty, but he insists that the Daughters of Ares aren't terrorists. He reminds her that the Corps has always been greedy, while the Rim has always been prideful, and sure, they need order, but not the same old kind. And he doesn't stop there. Even Darrow admits that this is the most verbose he's ever seen Diomedes. It's the most verbose anybody's seen Diomedes. But he's not just verbose. He's firm AF when he says, I will not swallow this monstrous lie of Atlas. I will not make nice with Atalantia, who treats the lives of millions as a game. Akari asked for gold to be philosopher kings, and maybe we were that way once. Now we are just dragons guarding our treasures. We may be superior in intelligence, in our lifespans, in our capacity for violence, but not in our humanity. We failed, Grandmother, long before Atlas set his warlord on us, long before Rhea. We are medieval. We are grotesque. I love you with all my heart, but you represent a past that fears the future. I will not accept that. So if it is true that the young cannot teach the old, and the old must always teach the young, kill me, for I will learn no other way.
Okay, so based on that line, are the loons Smaug? Who's Smaug in this?
I think all of the golds fighting Darrow.
Smaug.
No, those are other dragons. Which one's Smaug?
All right, but then you're going to get into an argument about who's Glaurung and who's Ancaligon the Black, and we don't have time.
I would say at this point, Atalantia is probably Smaug.
You know what? No. I have some respect for Smaug.
Okay. Legit.
All right. Thankfully, Gaia finally gives in. Not entirely, maybe, grudgingly, but enough to agree that she is the dusk now. Diomedes is the dawn, and she has had her say, so she will now help him have his. Essentially, despite Gaia's original resistance, when it comes down to it, she really steps up and helps Diomedes as he tries to convince the other moon lords of the need to enter an alliance with Darrow against Atalantia. Now, I have a question on this. Do you think Gaia really meant what she said? Or was she just knowing that that was going to be the arguments the moon lords made against Diomedes, and she was just putting them up herself so that Diomedes had the opportunity to argue against it? Was that a plot by her that was more subtle to help Diomedes earlier?
You mean like what she said to Diomedes or what she said in the meeting with the Moon Lords?
What she said in the meeting with the Moon Lords originally. Was it a whole time she was on his side, or was she really arguing for her point of view?
So I don't remember exactly what was said in that moment, but I remember when I was listening to it, it felt like what the Moon Lords were saying was against what Gaia actually sort of stood for. So even though she wasn't 100% on their side, I do think she was arguing in good faith in that moment.
Yeah, I agree, because her interrupting their outburst by pointing out how many of them fled or hid while Darrow slayed Fa and Diomedes fought to rescue their people, it was great. I keep saying this, but A++++ Gaia, no notes. And I don't think this was necessarily her. I mean, she didn't know what the Moon Lords were going to say in response to Diomedes' plan. I'm sure she knew that they were going to disagree with it, but
yeah.
So I don't think she necessarily planned one way or another, but she did tell Diomedes, as you said, that I've had my say, I'm old, now I guess it's your turn, so I will help you have your say. And that's exactly what she did. She didn't necessarily say, I 1000% agree with everything Diomedes is trying to do here, but what she did was interrupt their bullshit to be like, you flew away, you hid behind your shields, all of your people were dying and you did nothing, and Darrow and my grandson did everything. So that's exactly what she did, was help him have his say.
And I do think, like, in that moment, when especially when she's dressing them down for basically hiding and fleeing and, like, trying to save their own lives instead of trying to actually protect their people, I think she would have talked shit about them even if it wasn't helping Diomedes. I think she basically was like, you guys are fucking ridiculous. What the fuck is wrong with you people? Also, Diomedes is the fucking greatest. You shits are nothing. Eat a bag of dicks.
He's her little storm.
Little storm, little baby.
When she
storm.
Called him that, it was like, it's so. Also, when she like so fondly calls him her little storm, it's so cute. Which is not the thing you would normally think or say about Gaia or Diomedes, but it is very cute.
It is. I love it.
while Diomedes might be wrong about Lysander, he's not wrong in the rest of what he says, that their worlds are fragile and far apart, and it is in their nature to be practical, except when they don't want to be, which is a lot of the time. He continues, "We are furious because trading those dockyards was not our choice. We take pride in having a choice. But isolation is not a choice. It is a fate. If we do not pick a side, others will choose for us."
What they don't know is that others, a.k.a. Lysander the Liar, already have chosen for them. Which is proven when, before they agree to Diomedes' plan, that little pixie shit tight beams in to talk a whole lot of shit.
Worse than the shit talking, though, is Cassius's body on display and Darrow's reaction to seeing his beautiful, beautiful, brave friend, his arms broken, body mutilated with dozens of bullet holes and stab wounds, and his sword hand missing.
Tears stream down Darrow's face as he thinks, "This is a nightmare. I'll wake up in my bunk on the Archie and find him yawning in the cockpit. I cover my mouth to stop myself from crying out in pain. Why did he go? Why did he have to go? Why didn't he just wait for me on the ship? It's such a waste. I just got him back. I can't think of anything but him smiling on the Archimedes when I told him we were brothers, and he agreed, and how he then just sat there in such contentment, so safe with me. Why did he go? I don't want to be here. I want to be home with Virginia's arms around me, or back with him in the cockpit. We should have stayed on Europa. We should have fought. Dying at his side would have been better than this. I traded him for all the ships. All these moon lords. He was worth all of them put together."
Pause for emotion.
But there isn't much time for more.
Wait, no, we're pausing for emotion.
That was the pause.
Damn it, Jonathan.
No.
That was the pause.
No, there's way more
pause. That's not how it works. You don't say pause for emotion, and then that's the pause. A moment of silence. Oh, silence is over.
Really, though, even before Darrow goes into this sort of diatribe about, like, why did he have to go? Why did he have to go? Why did he have to go? When he sees, like, Cassius is missing his sword hand, he's also thinking about, like, that's the hand that he used to correct me when I was holding my razor wrong when he was teaching me. That's the hand he drank with. That's the hand he put on my shoulder when I called him brother. And I'm just like, But really, just the whole thing where Darrow sees his sword hand missing, and that kind of starts his, like, spiral into darkness, like, because he's thinking about, this is the hand he did this, this is the hand he did that with. This is also probably the hand he did other things with, if you want me to be amusing right now. That said, oh, God.
But there isn't much time for mourning, because while it's interesting that the Moon Lords seem to be listening to Lysander's bullshit, slandering Diomedes of all people, as soon as he demands they release Darrow to him, they stand in unison against the ultimatum, screaming, "We are not Freys!"
Which in turn leads to Lysander leveling the attack that, let's be real, he probably always meant to make, because that's just who he is. The little fucking shit.
But Darrow and Diomedes and the others are totally caught off guard. Like, guys, did you... They're in slippers, for fuck's sake. Still, while some of the Moon Lords die as their meeting place collapses around them, most escape, with most of the thanks for that going to Darrow, since he's the one who rushed to hold up the pillars.
Also, I feel the need to point out that while Darrow has proverbially held the worlds on his shoulders for about half his life, this is a bit more of a literal take on a Darrow to Atlas comparison. Though, thankfully, he doesn't have to carry that literal weight for all of eternity and does, in fact, end up receiving help from Diomedes, some Rim Olympic knights, and even Greca Alcodovan of Ganymede, despite her being the person whose docks he destroyed.
And really, y'all, just when you think Lysander couldn't get worse, you find out he has burned the Eastern Garter and doesn't seem to care. The fire is spreading to the west, even as he uproots their special plants, stealing them to supposedly plant on Mercury.
Worse than that, though, is what happens when he meets up with Cicero, who's watching the fire creep across the fields toward a line of several dozen brown growers, and tells Lysander how they name each tree and sing to them because it makes the trees happy, and happy trees produce better fruit.
Side note, anyone else unable to hear happy trees without thinking of Bob Ross?
It's a happy little tree.
Those poor happy little trees.
I've and never those heard poor that song.
It's not a song. It's Bob Ross, the painter.
What?
Happy trees make some happy trees.
And he paints happy trees.
He has the, like, afro and the, like, and he paints thing.
Jonathan, like, dude, fuck? He died when I was like 12 years old, and I still know who he is.
Never heard of him.
You have to. You know who Bob Ross is. Maybe you don't recognize the name, but either way, the happy trees just, this is not a happy time, and those trees are not happy right now. And neither are the poor people who care for them, just like Bob Ross would be if someone was burning down his happy trees. Anyway.
Lysander asks why the growers aren't in the sanctuary, and Cicero, who looks miserable, explains, they said the trees were their children and they will die for them. Then they spat on me. I know the Ra and Darrow tried to kill you, but these growers, they just live here. What they said was beautiful. This place was beautiful.
To which Lysander whines about how the Garter is military infrastructure. No, that feeds sedition. Whatever, you fucking jerk. And when Cicero claims they'll be named Ash Lords, Lysander insists that's not the case because Burning Rhea targeted the Heart of the Rebellion. Well, they've targeted the stomach. So clearly they're better, right, you fucking cunt? Sorry, I got
to. Seriously, though? Speaking of stomachs, I can't stomach this. Or him, to be honest.
He better die so much in the next book. I want to see them kill him and then bring him back so they can kill him again.
Pierce Brown, I know you're never going to listen to this, but if you've ever fucking listened to this and Lysander does not die a horrible fucking death,
talking about a death like Prospero died in the spoiler for Fall of the House of Usher.
Oh, no.
Ooh. Yeah, that is. I mean, not for me because I've seen it, but that is a spoiler.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's not that much of a spoiler.
So for anybody who's listening to this, please go watch Fall of the House of Usher if you can deal with horror and haven't watched it yet. If you have watched it, yes, I agree. Prospero's death.
And if you don't like horror, Lessons in Chemistry is a good alternative.
There you go.
So eventually Lysander convinces Cicero to leave with him, but I think it's interesting that Cicero looks back to watch the growers burn. Does anybody have any thoughts on possible future sedition in the ranks?
100%.
Cicero absolutely is clearly not happy with this.
But yeah, I think Cicero gonna die.
Yes.
I think he's gonna be like,
also yes,
Lysander, you're being terrible. We need to help the Locullus, and all you've done is be a complete shit. And Lysander's gonna shoot him in the face.
Yep.
I think it's gonna come down to the genocide. And Cicero is going to stand up to Lysander, and that's when Lysander is going to kill the shit out of him.
But it's also possible that Cicero tries to mend the ways of Lysander when Pierce Brown totally destroys you and makes him the hero of this saga.
I mean, not the hero necessarily, but I would not put it past.
No, makes Lysander the hero of the saga.
No,
if that happens, I'm done.
Like, I can't. There's no way he could come back from this. There I was trained by the book, best swordsman ever, but I need to shoot people in their face.
I do think there was a point in this book where if that's the direction Pierce wanted to go, he could have gone that direction. Like, literally, when Kasha shows up and is like, hey, we can do this together. We can fix things. If that was the direction Pierce wanted to go, he could have, after Atlas and Rowan are taken out, started building that.
Yeah, especially if Cassius had died fighting Atlas and Rome.
Even if he hadn't, he could have had Lysander come back from the brink or start to come back from the brink by accepting Cassius. But he very much didn't do that. So that's not the direction we're headed in.
Yeah, and speaking of sedition in the ranks, Pytha is big mad and obviously for very good reason.
Love how she promises to kill Lysander if she sees him again, is glad that Cassius, the true knight, is the one who killed Atlas, and even tries to fire on Lysander as she takes off in the Archie.
It's really too bad that he thought to nerf those cannons.
Yeah.
Ugh. Ugh.
Lysander pulling out the Eidme cubes that represent red and gold is one thing. But what are everyone's thoughts on him thinking, the only question I have left to ponder is, which, were he in my position, Selenius would use first?
Does he mean that he would target the reds or the golds on Mars first? or target either all reds everywhere or all golds everywhere first? Like, I'm assuming it's the former because the latter would end up possibly targeting him and his allies, but it's vague. And also, even if you're trying to just target red or gold people on Mars, couldn't that also possibly end up amongst your ranks as mm-hmm. well?
It's like, it's real hard to control a pandemic, as we've seen.
Is this a pandemic weapon or is it just a toxin that impacts them? It's a bioweapon, yes, but there's a difference between, like,
we don't know anything enough about
it. It's going to dissipate in 6 hours that will kill every red.
I guess
and it is a disease that you spread to each other.
He's only got the one box per color.
Mm-hmm.
So I assumed that if you were going to target multiple planets, it's got to be something that's communicable and has a relatively long incubation period.
At least I interpret that as these are the samples that they can just make lots of if they need to.
I mean, maybe. I don't know.
That's how I interpreted that.
I'm also like, if you're going
to... We know almost nothing about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're speculating. That's what we do.
And that's what I'm saying. What I'm speculating is even if they don't make more, this would have to be such a very specific thing where there's still a good chance that it's going to kill some allies of his, be they gold or red, on Mars. It's a much slighter chance on Mars, obviously, than it would be anywhere else. But if it is communicable between members of that color, then somebody essentially could get exposed to it on Mars and bring it to Mercury or Luna. As Nick said, we know very, very little about the specifics of this, and whether that's weak writing or Pierce withholding information, I don't know. I would lean more toward the latter than the former, to be honest. But either way, it seems very unlikely that whatever it is so controllable that Lysander could just be like, here, I'm going to release this on Mars to kill all the golds on Mars, and that it would not somehow also harm golds elsewhere if somebody from Mars was exposed to it and then escaped. It is very vague. I'm entirely sure it's purposefully vague. I don't know. I don't like it. I don't like it being so vague. I don't like it at all. And I don't like Lysander. And I hate this thing that exists. And I hate that he let it exist. And I hate that he killed Cassius so that he could have it exist. And I hate all of it. Thank you. Goodbye. Okay, not really. Goodbye.
An excellent summary.
Before we get into the serious stuff from the final chapter, I just want to say one thing. Why is everyone so obsessed with snow globes?
Brought to you by the fact that one of Pax's favorite things that Darrow brought back for him was one of a city trapped in perpetual winter, taken from a collection one of the defeated golds had of glass globes with tiny models of cities.
But also brought to you by the fact that I swear I keep reading and or seeing media that features snow globes and snow globe collections recently. Though, of course, right now I'm blanking on naming any of them. I swear to God, I recently read, I think it was like a post-apocalyptic thing where there was like a weird snow globe situation in it. And I read so much so fast that I'm not quite remembering why this stood out to me in terms of like what I'm comparing it to. But anyway, I know it's a silly side note, but I was like, why snow globes? Why is everybody so upset? Why do people keep snow globes? They take up so much room and they're...
Is it time to talk about Saint Elsewhere and the Westphal hypothesis?
No.
The what?
It's not.
Yes, no, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it right now.
So, well, now I need to know what it is. So
spoilers for a TV show that's like going on 35 years old at this point or more. The end of Saint Elsewhere, which was a medical drama, revealed that Saint Elsewhere was a building that was contained inside a snow globe, the toy of an autistic child. So the entire series was then revealed to have been a dream in the mind of an autistic child. And since there were enough crossovers with Saint Elsewhere of characters that later had crossovers with other series, the Westphal hypothesis is essentially that something like a quarter of television is actually a dream in the mind of an autistic child.
Yep.
I don't know how I feel about that. Well, but also, when I was reading the beginning of this chapter, the snow globe stood out to me and I was like, why snow globes? All I know is that it is absolutely something I have read or seen within the past year. And I think it's been multiple things where there was a snow globe thing. And so I was like, why are they so obsessed with snow globes? I don't know. Listen, whatever. It's a silly aside because I needed to put a silly aside in here because so much of this episode is depressing as fuck. Okay.
Yeah.
Let me have my stupid snow globe moment.
Let's move on.
Back to the matters at hand, but still not overly serious ones, because first you have to give props to Severo for calling Diomedes a fool for trusting Lysander, and then telling Gaia, "Shut up, crone," when she tells Severo to show Diomedes respect.
Not so amusing is the arrival of Volga, Athena, and Lyria, because Darrow is none too happy to see that Volga carries Fa's warsaw, though he's proud to see Volga wearing the ashes that show her shame on her face, because he knows that it was Lyria's idea.
When Lyria sees Darrow, her eyes well up, and he thinks, somewhere, maybe in the void or the veil, Cassius would smile to see his accidental protege is yet again more than meets the eye.
They are, of course, there to sign the covenant, which doesn't solve all the things, because the Rim won't be allowed to prosecute the Voke or seek restitution for the liberated Obsidians who are joining them. The Voke didn't get to keep any of their spoils of war, and Athena apparently didn't get the complete abolition of the hierarchy that she wanted, or total ownership of the Deep. At least, not yet.
Okay, so I will say this, that while Darrow was really mad about Volga bringing Fa's warsaw, I can't remember who it was, but somebody else is like, we said we wouldn't bring any weapons. And she's like, oh yeah, right. And she brings it out and breaks it over her knee. And Darrow's like, oh, okay, this was planned. Like, that was absolutely weakened beforehand so that she could break it over her knee. So it was very symbolic. I'm sure it might've been a small part Lyria's idea as well as Volga's, but Darrow was mad about it at first, but then he kind of took that anger back.
Yeah. Darrow notes that in the end, no one is happy, which means it is probably the only document anyone could sign with even the slightest suspicion that it might actually be honored by the others.
Yeah, you guys, compromise. Nobody's ever happy when there's a compromise. Not entirely, anyway. People who are involved in a proper compromise, like, should at least be like a little bit okay with it, but you know. Now, we haven't seen much of Aure lately, but when Darrow points out that the Core Golds can't afford to trust one another, but the members of this alliance can't afford not to trust each other, Aure steps forward to say, many pinks are not destined for high halls and must know how to sense dark intentions behind even the kindest eyes. When I look at you, I sense you are all growing toward the light. There's something sacred in that because you all represent a people, people who yearn for something more, for something they've never had. Loon, Grimace, they are trying to reclaim what they have lost. Control. There is nothing sacred in that. They do not lead, they pull, they corral, they confine. Their path has only room for one. Your path has room for you all.
After Ari's pronouncement, they all start to peel off in their own directions, though Volga stops to tell Darrow she is sorry about Cassius. With Lyria snorting and Severo rolling his eyes in the background, Volga goes on to say that Cassius was the most handsome man I have ever seen. And I hear he was very kind. I wish I could have known him better. Loon will die. He has broken Lyria's heart.
Which, aw. And more awe when Darrow stops to tell Lyria that Cassius was quite fond of her. And Lyria just rushes to him and hugs his hips because that's how tall she is, leading him to kneel and give her a real hug. Hearts. So many hearts.
Don't worry, though. We're not quite done with the emotional shit yet, because Darrow stops to inform Aure that people have saved his life before, but she has saved his soul.
Sorry, I need to pick a bow here.
All right.
To which Aure responds, and you saved Cassius's. It wasn't me. I liked him very much. In another life, I might have loved him. But he didn't need a woman's love. He needed a brother's. The way he talked about you... Lysander was an obligation. You were an aspiration. He was so afraid on our journey to the core, so nervous to see you and be rejected. But when he saw you respected him, valued him, he shined like a light. His path led back to you because you made him feel loved. That is all that matters. When he died, he knew he was loved. So when you think of him, when you feel sad, remember that. If we do not meet again, I will see you in the Vale with Cassius. You know the path. I'm glad I gave you Darrow's speech earlier, Seth, because I was like, I don't think I can read this without choking up and possibly crying.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
But in this particular instance, I did want to kind of stop and talk a little bit about the idea of Cassius needing a brother's love over a romantic love. Because like we know from Cassius's past that he had his little flings and stuff before the Institute, and they went to the Institute and he had his little fling with Quinn. And I think that was a little more serious. I absolutely believe that he cared for Quinn. And then, you know, they ended up on opposite sides of a little fight, mm-hmm. little tiff with the Darrow thing. Mm-hmm. And then he was with Mustang and he clearly loved her, but she was
like, you're good until I figure out how to get back with Darrow. Yeah. Maybe one of the coldest things she's ever done.
Yeah.
I think probably the coldest thing she's ever done, honestly, in terms of personal coldness, yeah, you know, yeah. One-on-one coldness. But I did really like that while Cassius had his little crush on Aure, you know, saying you're in love with somebody who doesn't reciprocate it is a little bit meh to me.
Yeah.
But I really did like that that's the way Pierce went with this, that Cassius did not need romantic love. He needed the love of a brother, a person he respected who would respect him back.
I think the number of times romantic interest is used in any plot, like ever, like story plots, is enough. We mm-hmm. don't need more. I am much happier to see plots that are centered around friendship and other forms of relationship. And yes, romantic relationships are important. And I'm not saying we never need another romantic relationship plot ever. I'm just saying I would be very happy to see more plots that centered friendships or other styles of relationship or other forms of relationship versus, oh, we have to have romance here. And also I would be very, very happy if we eliminated more plots that were like, oh, we have to fight because of romantic interests mm-hmm. in the same person or something like that.
Yes, more polyamory, please.
Yes.
My favorite question to ask on my shows is, would polyamory have solved it?
Yes.
Anytime there's a love conflict. Triangle, my question is, would polyamory have solved mm-hmm. it? And sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes it's no, but sometimes it is yes.
In Twilight, if they had just formed a throuple, it would have solved a lot of problems. After the tent scene, I feel like it's a natural.
I mean, would it have solved Edward's abuse?
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on.
I said a lot of problems, not all the problems. Jesus fucking Christ.
I never read Twilight. I asked Talia if I should read it because she read it when her friend recommended it. And she goes, the plot is fine, but it is so poorly written, it is not worth reading. And she was like 12 when she told me that. So
I actually disagree. I think that the writing is actually, it is super digestible. The mm-hmm. plot is terrible.
Well, but also that's the difference between a 12-year-old and an adult too.
Yes, like, fair, sure. Very fair. 100%.
But also I respect Talia for recognizing that there were yes. problems with that series at 12 years.
Lots of respect to your daughter for that.
I did also want to touch on how much foreshadowing you guys think there might be in that I'll see you in the veil, you know the path bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go one by one. What do we think the odds are of Darrow surviving this series? Because I would say they are at best 15%, and that is being extremely generous. What about you, Seth? You're going to disagree with me, maybe, I think?
I want to disagree. I think, I don't know. I mean, maybe he's going to go off and do something stupid and heroic, which is his MO, like charge exactly. in without really thinking about it. Or alternately, come up with a crafty and probably overthought plan that's going to do something. It's one of the two, sometimes both at the same time. I don't know. I'm giving him bigger than 15% odds. But I'm also going to say by that same token, I don't know that Aure rates her own survival as terribly likely in the upcoming conflict.
My question is, define survives the series. Do we mean at the end there's an epilogue that says 30 years later, Darrow is dead? In which case he
No, I mean dies in
some heroic or non-heroic manner before the end of the actual story.
I'm sure it would be heroic over non-heroic, but yeah, I would say dies before the end of the current timeline story, not an epilogue. What do you think his chances are of actually surviving to the end of the current timeline of the series?
75%.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Okay.
I actually think it's more likely that he survives, but is somewhat of a shattered person because all the people he loved are dead. Didn't survive.
No, because if Virginia doesn't survive, I'm rioting. Mm-hmm. I don't care if it's one man riot. I'm rioting.
Did you give a percent chance, Seth?
I think it's somewhere closer to 50-50. Yeah. I don't think it's above 50-50, mm-hmm. but I think it's closer to 50-50.
Okay. What about you, Nick?
That's kind of where I am too.
I the one who has the highest survival rate for Ordero.
Yes. And unfortunately, because Seth and Nick both chose 50-50 and I chose such a low percent, but you chose such a high percent, we're looking at a 47.5% chance that he survives. So less than 50% between the four of us, I mean, and our predictions. Okay, well.
And now we reach the end, in which Severo brings Darrow to Cassius's room, a place we've never read about before, where the walls are covered with pictures of his home and family, a House Mars pendant surrounded by news clippings of Darrow's pack. And not just Darrow and Severo either, but Screwface, Clown, Pebble, Virginia, even Pax. Happy moments that Cassius himself never got to share in.
Most importantly, however, is the holoprojector, as Severo notes that Cassius has hundreds of hours of Institute footage before reminding Darrow that there's a long trip home and asking where they should start watching. And what is on that hundreds of hours that he kept?
Well, let's hope that some of the more prurient details were edited out.
I think it's all Institute footage is the way it's portrayed.
Yes, but what did those proctors really want to watch?
I mean, to be fair, those proctors were pretty much all gross.
That is fair.
With the obvious exception. Darrow replies, wherever he left off. And together, he and Severo, who are now at the age of many of the proctors who watched their antics from Olympia, watch three boys ride their horses across a moonlit plain. Darrow recalls, the boys were us once, drunk on victory. They carried an owl standard and howled like idiots at the moon. We were idiots. Trapped in a world of lies, maybe the howls were the truest things that came out of our mouths. We were all just lonely and in search of a pack.
Which again has me just like, And also these are some of the few good memories they had with Cassius at the Institute, and the fact that that's where Cassius stopped watching. And I imagine he stopped watching like right before he landed on the Lightbringer. Anyway, the two of them, Severo and Darrow, are heading home to the rest of their pack with the army and armada they promised, with another promise, the one that they will win this war to try and keep. Okay, guys, deep breath here, because it's time for the in memoriam we've all been waiting for, but at least partially dreading.
The Moon Lords, young, old, and in between, who lost their lives trying to escape in their slippers when Lysander, fucking asshole that he is, attacked them.
The brown growers who stood their ground when Lysander burned their happy little trees alive. We're hoping they met with Bob Ross in the Vale and are enjoying tree things together.
Marcus, Drusilla, some other unnamed Gorgon assholes, and of course Rhone, who was so desperate for his revenge on the Rim that he became yet another Atlas puppet and died on the ground at the hands of a pixie like Lysander. An Atlas, whose hair had become too big with secrets, and whose pithy responses were not enough to save his life, but he didn't die before sharing some deep secrets about Lysander.
Can I just, real quick, the amount of building up that Pierce Brown did for both Atlas and Fa, only to have them go out the way they did in these books. It's like, these are the big scare. They're huge. They're scary. They're big. It's, oh, they're dead now. They're dead. No, it's fine. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
I actually disagree. I think both of their deaths were fucking epic.
Yeah.
And had to be set up for this book, because in order for us to end with one more book, and Atalantia being the big bad.
Well, we've still got Atalantia, Lysander, and fucking Abominadrius.
Yeah. So they had to be eliminated, this book.
Oh, no, I know they did.
I feel like the way that they were killed was extremely appropriate and really well done. Like, I have some other complaints about things that Pierce did in this book. Volga is a great example of that. But these deaths, mwah.
Yeah. Well, all right.
They also both lasted like pages and pages. I mean, Fa's death was like two chapters coming.
I know. It's just the menace with which he appeared in the last book was not the level of, it's like this. For me, it felt a little bit like comic book writing. Everybody is as powerful as you need them to be for the plot to work.
Well, that's true with every book.
Some are a little less than it. Anyway. I'm done. I don't want to get in the way of the last in memoriam, because we all know what's coming.
The last and most important.
Oh, then we need to include the Askamani first, then. No one felt bad for the poor Askamani. But they were attacking under false pretenses. They were manipulated.
Jonathan, you're reaching.
Like, okay. Yes, all of the low colors that died that we didn't talk about. Yes, find them. Yes. The Askamani, they can go fuck themselves.
Yeah, go fuck yourself.
All right. Last, but very much not least, most importantly, and I will say personally, this death hit me harder than any in the series so far, including Ragnar, which I thought it would be super hard to top Ragnar unless it was Sevro. And I'm, you know, who knows what's going to come next? Jesus Christ. But that said, in memoriam of Cassius Bellona, now known as the man who killed Fear, but forever and always, son of Tiberius, son of Julia, brother of Darrow, friend to Lyria, morning knight of the Solar Republic, whose honor fucking remains. It's just... And like, I at the end of these episodes, I always ask you guys if you have any last thoughts. So having read this book twice through and then having gone over these end chapters, actually more than once this time, because I was trying to capture everything, like I'm pretty sure I could read this 10 times and still tear up. I mean, really honestly cry, not, you know, sobbing, but like tears actually coming from my eyes and running down my face about Cassius's death. And of course, that isn't the only thing that is important in these last 11 chapters, but it is so important for Lysander's devolvement and for Darrow's moving forward. And really also for Lyria's plot too, because now she has this person that she had become so close to. And because of that, Volca is now like, I'm gonna kill that bitch. So everybody is after Lysander now, and half of them is mostly because he killed Cassius. Because I don't want to do a whole separate episode on predictions, but now that we're at the end of a sixth book that we waited, well, that I and Jonathan waited like many years for, but even though Nick and Seth, you guys didn't wait as long, this is the first cliffhanger in this series, I think, that you guys really are having to wait a while for. So I'm interested. We'll start with Nick and then we'll go Jonathan and then Seth, so that we're doing opposite of the way we did last time. So what are your thoughts on Lightbringer as a whole? Do you have any predictions you want to throw out there?
Overall, I really liked Lightbringer. I think Pierce is a great writer. I think he had, particularly some of the scenes that he did in this book, were some of his best writing. As we've talked about, I'm still not over the defamation that he did to Volga's character. I feel like that was some of his worst writing that we've seen. And I think there are a few other things where he just kind of didn't really follow through in the way that I would have liked to have seen. We've talked about that plenty here, of the connective tissue isn't always as cohesive. But overall, Lightbringer was a fantastic book. I think it set up Lysander as irredeemable and the true big bad beautifully, even as we rail against how fucking terrible he is and how much he's the worst. It is kind of gratifying in a way to see that fulfilled and to see him truly become the actual worst. I think in the final book, there's going to be some really interesting confrontations, particularly centered around the imminent genocide of people and how people side on that in terms of the society golds and how they deal with that knowledge and what they do with it is going to be really interesting. And the inevitable like killings that Lysander commits in the name of bringing the society back to its former glory, which was never good and should never have been a thing that he pursued, but whatever, what the fuck do I know? Those will be some of the really interesting points. I think we already talked a little bit about Cicero and how that's, I think, going to be a dividing point. But then there also ends up being potential fallout from that with some of his other allies because of Cicero, which would be really interesting. I would love to see Cicero not become a hero, I think, because it's way too late for that, but at least to have an attempt to sway Golds away from Lysander, I think it would be really interesting. It'll be very interesting to see how I think Atalantia is going to ultimately be dethroned.
A weak ass bitch.
So it'll be interesting to see how that's handled, whether Lysander ends up doing that or whether it's Virginia or somebody else. And then, of course, we haven't really heard anything from Abominadrius in a really long time. Personally, I'd honestly be kind of happy if they just let that thread die, but that would be very bad writing. It will be interesting to see how that happens. I think ultimately what would be really interesting, and I think actually possible, is for him to ally himself against Lysander, which could be a really cool kind of like twist on that.
I mean, I'm terrible at predicting things because the last book I had certain predictions and this book did not follow virtually any of them. I think I actually don't think Lysander is going to be taken down by any of our major characters. I think it's going to be Cicero being a Brutus and stabbing him in the back.
Interesting.
I like that idea.
Yeah.
And then the big bad, I think they're going to return essentially to Adrius, as much as that probably is more a stereotype of this type of story. But since he started as the bad, I think he finishes as the bad.
I don't know. That would be a little anticlimactic for me. We haven't really had enough of him, unless we get a whole lot of him in the next book to be like, he's the big bad. I don't have any predictions so much as I am interested to see how playing available bad guy pool is going to go, because it's going to be interesting to see who knocks out who, because I don't think it's realistic to expect Darrow and the gang to take care of Lysander and Atalantia and Lilith, and I guess Lilith and Abominadrius are the same, but there's three that they got to do, and I'd like to see at least one set of bad guys knock out another set of bad guys. I don't like it, but I'm gonna go ahead and make a slight prediction on the Severo mindfuck. I think that's still a possibility. I think it's really weird that they would have been like, yeah, we could mind control you, but we're not gonna. So we'll see.
I think it's most likely that Lysander is gonna knock out Atalantia. And then there's going to be some sort of weird, like, who's the worst bad guy now? Is it Abominadrius, who we haven't heard from in a billion years? Or is it Lysander? P.S. It's still probably Lysander somehow.
Yeah.
It's always Lysander.
Yeah. I don't know that I have, like, predictions per se, because, like Jonathan said, I had things that I thought were going to happen in this book that really got... Well, and to be honest, when Pierce announced that it was going to be split into two books, I was like, oh gosh, all my predictions went out the window at that point anyway. This book was not what I expected at all. And maybe that's part of why I really loved it so much, why it toppled Morningstar as my favorite book in the series. So not by much, but yeah, this is my favorite book in the series right now, despite the hard stuff that happens at the end. So yeah, I'm interested to see Abominadrius come back and to find out whether it's him who is Virginia's mole in the society somehow, even though he's stuck on Luna. But yeah, no real predictions, just kind of, wow, how are you going to wrap this up in one book, Pierce? Please, please wrap it up in one book. I don't want to wait. God.
Yeah.
I don't want to wait a billion years and find out there's like two more books instead of just one. And also, I need to see Lysander die post-haste.
Yeah, we need yes. that.
Well, as we close out the episode, we just want to give a shout out to our Heroes to Your patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us. Once again, I'm Tara, along with fellow hosts Jonathan and Nick, and practically permanent guest host Seth. Don't forget that you can always hit us up at Sagas and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or Blue Sky, or email us at sagasandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have. Okay, so I said at the very beginning of this episode that this was not our final Red Rising Saga episode. And our next episode, which probably will be the final one until the next book comes out, is going to be a fun one. We're calling it Mars Madness.
Ooh.
And nice. We'll be pitting many Red Rising characters who at one point or another on this podcast we have called the worst against each other in brackets until we have narrowed the list down to just one character who will then be deemed, I don't know, the suckiest person in society is like the thing I'm going for now. If anybody who's listening to this has suggestions that have alliteration involved, I would love to hear them because I don't love suckiest person in society.
The slime of society?
I mean, the suckiest person in society is not wrong because all of the people who are on the list right now, other than possibly one, are very much society based. And saying that, so I have 8 people who are on the list. Absolutely. Then I have a poll that will be going out at some point. To be honest, I'm not quite sure when, but probably not long after we release this episode to the public, where you'll be able to vote for your top 2 contenders is what I'm hoping people will vote for, because it's hard to find a free polling site that limits votes without limiting it to just one. So anyway, stay tuned for Mars Madness. And I'm hoping it will only be one episode, but also we're definitely going to have at least 10 characters. So it might end up having to be broken down into two for time purposes. We'll see.
Do we want to avoid swearing? Because it could be the shittiest person in the solar system.
Oh, that's not bad either. The title of the episode will be Mars Madness. So yeah. I think we can say shittiest person in the solar system as long as it's not in the title.
And it's in the okay. And
stuff. Right. Yeah. I mean, we swear all the time on this podcast.
We certainly do. Especially about Lysander. Oh, fucking Lysander.
That said, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.